Du lytter til Radio Krishna på 87,6 MHz, en dybere dimension i radio. I den næste halvanden time her i Radio Krishna skal vi høre en forelæsning med vores videnskabsmand Sadabhuta. Han taler herover for et publikum i Belgien i et tempel, der hedder Radha Desh. Ja, det er en del af et længere seminarium dernede fra, og her specifikt handler det om to ting. Vi skal først høre her en diskussion om, hvordan bølgemønstre kan skabe forskellige figurer ved hjælp af matematiske beregninger, og hvordan det her det står i forhold til den teori inden for fysikken, at atomer og deres elementare partikler i virkeligheden ikke er andet end bølgeformer. Man skal lige give sig lidt tid til at komme igennem de første 5 minutter i den her forelæsning, hvor Sadabhuta beskriver et matematisk fænomen ved tavlen, og desværre kan vi ikke se det, men vi kan godt følge med, hvis vi lytter opmærksomt. Og hvis man så har lyttet opmærksomt til hans beskrivelse af dette bølgefænomen, så vil man forstå, hvad han mener med resten af hans oplæg i den første del af denne udsendelse. I den anden del, efter musikken, skal vi høre om evolution. Vi skal høre lidt om, hvordan fossile fund bliver misrepræsenteret. Det har vi selvfølgelig snakket om før her i Radio Krishna, men her kommer der nogle andre detaljer, og vi skal også høre et soundtrack fra en video desangående med efterfølgende diskussion og spørgsmål. Det er en studievært og tekniker, hedder Yadunandan Das. Jeg siger værsgo til Sadabhuta.
Present the mathematics of that wave phenomena that I was describing yesterday. How many would like me to present something? Okay, I'll present that. So, the point that I was making there was that you could generate any particular desired pattern from some initial pattern of waves. And this is based on the principle of a hologram. So here's how that works. I'll just briefly describe it. Suppose you have a plane. This is like a surface of water, let's say. Now you know, if you throw a stone into the water, you'll produce a disturbance at some point, and then ripples will spread out in a circle. Now, you can imagine reversing that in time. Then you can imagine a ripple that starts out here and then comes in and focuses at a single point. So mathematically that's possible, because if a wave can move in one direction, it can also move in the reverse direction. So let us say you want a pattern of waves to create a given shape. For example, you want to produce the letter A at a given time. So what I'm going to do is tilt the drawing, the plane sideways, so that we can draw the time axis. So here's time going this way. So this is this plane where the ripples are taking place, but we're looking at it from the side now. And we're plotting time on a perpendicular axis like this. What we want is the letter A to appear at this particular time. So at an earlier time, what we do, here's the same thing at an earlier time. Now, for this ripple pattern, if this is the plane at one time, and you throw the stone, and you make your disturbance here, then at a later time, you're going to get a ripple that's spread out like that, let's say. And at a still later time, the ripples spread even more, like that. So it's like a cone that's spreading out as time passes. And likewise, you can go in the reverse time direction. And for earlier times, of course, this doesn't happen when you throw a stone, but mathematically you can do it. So a ripple pattern can correspond to two cones that meet at a given point. Okay? So this is a solution of the wave equation in physics that looks like this. It has the property that it produces a disturbance at one point, at one time, and at earlier times it's a ripple that's moving in and shrinking, and at later times the ripple is expanding out. So that, with that mathematical device, here's what you can do. For each point on the A, you draw such a cone, and at this earlier time, we have a particular ripple for that point. Now you do that for each point, and you just add these ripples together. Now you can superimpose waves, you can add them. So for each point you add them. So you'll have a bunch of ripples that are added one on top of another. And there's what's called wave interference when you add them. In some places they add and in some places they subtract. So what you'll get here is a complicated pattern. But what happens is if you start with this pattern of waves, then each ripple pattern acts as though it's by itself. This is the nature of the waves. So at this time, each one will be focused to the given point, which we used in order to determine that ripple. And thus, at this time, you'll have the letter A appearing. Now suppose at a later time, you want to have the letter B, let's say. Well, you just add more ripple patterns. You can, for each point on the B, you add another circle or ellipse back here. You do the same thing that you did for the A. So then what happens is, at this time, the A appears, and then it disappears. And then at this later time, the B appears, and then it disappears. All starting with this initial pattern. So the point of all that is that starting with some kind of wave pattern, you can produce any desired shape on the surface of the water at a given time later on. Now, this is how holograms work. Here I'm using this axis as time, but with a hologram, it would be space, and you'd see a three-dimensional image floating in space. For example, you can make a hologram showing an A and a B that float in space on two parallel planes. But here we're just doing it in time. So this just shows mathematically how you can create an initial wave pattern which will produce any desired form. So then the point I was making yesterday, there are two points to make. One is that if matter is basically a wave phenomenon, as you have in quantum mechanics, then you could start with some wave pattern and generate all kinds of material forms in principle. In practice, we can't do it because the wavelength is too short for the quantum waves. But in principle, that could happen if you had something that would generate the appropriate initial wave pattern. So if you look at matter on a microscopic level or an atomic level, you see that there's continual patterns of vibration running through matter. This produces what we call heat. So the general idea in physics is that those patterns are completely random. And if they are random or disorderly, then you don't expect them to produce any organized result like this. However, if an element of non-randomness was introduced by intelligent agency, then that would give the possibility of generating any desired large-scale patterns. Of course, the point behind the whole thing is that Supersoul, by adjusting the patterns of wave motion on a subatomic level, could, in principle, generate all kinds of large-scale forms, whatever was desired. And that was the point, just to show the possibility of that kind of thing. And so one should keep in mind this is not a proof that Supersoul does this, or even that Supersoul controls things in this way. But the objective is to show that in the context of modern scientific ideas, such a thing is perfectly possible or plausible. So it's not unreasonable to think that God is controlling everything in nature, directing all the different phenomena that are taking place. So that's the point of the exercise. Yeah?
Do we accept the idea that everything which is mathematically possible is physically possible? And conversely, that whatever is mathematically impossible is impossible physically?
As far as physical theories are concerned, if you have a given theoretical framework and you can show that a given thing is mathematically possible within that framework, then it's physically possible as far as that theory is concerned. That becomes a prediction of the theory then. So that's what physicists actually do. They will say, all right, we have this mathematical system. Just by analyzing the mathematics, we see that a given thing should be possible. So they will say, this must actually be possible in nature, or else our whole theory is wrong. Sometimes remarkable discoveries have been made that way. For example, this Brian Josephson in England was mathematically analyzing the quantum theory, and he came to a certain conclusion that a certain phenomenon should occur. And then experiments were performed, and sure enough, it really did happen, and no one had anticipated that previously. So physicists would accept that if something is mathematically possible within the framework of the theory, then it should be possible in nature. I should point out here, by the way, that this is a discussion within the framework of scientific theories. Now, as a matter of fact, there's a lot of evidence that things are happening in nature which don't at all agree with the laws of physics. However, within the scientific community, such phenomena are denied. There's the whole subject of parapsychology, psychical phenomena of different kinds. And most of these seem to violate the laws of physics. And physicists don't accept that such things happen. So that's a whole controversial area. But this is just intended to show that even if you grant their suppositions about the laws of physics, still it is possible to have control of nature by a transcendental supreme consciousness. Yeah?
When you say violate the law of physics, what exactly what do you mean? You mean that the relationship between two independent events they can't demonstrate?
Yeah, an example would be clairvoyance or mental telepathy. These are names that are used. A person may claim to be able to perceive some event that has occurred at a great distance, or to be able to perceive what someone else is thinking. There's a lot of evidence indicating that this really happens, but there's no known physical mechanism to account for it. You can't explain it by radio transmission. First of all, the brain doesn't transmit radio waves of any strength anyway. There are many difficulties in any kind of electromagnetic explanation. There are no other known phenomena that would transmit information over large distances. So therefore, it should be impossible for this kind of thing to happen. But there's a lot of evidence that it does happen. So physicists will tend to reject that. You see, at present, physical scientists do not accept the existence of a more subtle form of energy that you may call mind. But let us suppose they were to accept that, and that they were to accept that different phenomena that we're interested in are being directly caused by this more subtle energy through some kind of interaction. Then the question will be, does that more subtle energy work simply according to mechanical laws of some kind? And if so, then we're back to the same question that we're dealing with here. Because then you have to account for how there's a link between that energy and something transcendental to it. So essentially we have two pictures here. On the one hand, there's the description of the material energy given in the Sankhya philosophy, which says that you have pradana and then from pradana you have false ego, and then in goodness, passion, and ignorance you have mind, intelligence, and gross matter, and the different senses, and so forth. So we understand that from a transcendental level, the pradana is manipulated, and all these further manifestations take place as a result of that manipulation. And that is done by Mahavishnu, who expands into Garbhadakshay Vishnu and Kshiradakshay Vishnu, who's the super soul, and so forth. So, on the one hand, we have that. What we're doing here, as far as physical science is concerned, is taking what you might say a greatly simplified version of that, and showing how it is plausible that the all-pervading supersoul could be manipulating the kind of fundamental fields known in modern physics in such a way as to direct the phenomena of nature. So there's a parallelism there between this argument of plausibility and the Sankhya philosophy. But obviously many things have been left out, such as the element called mind and the element called intelligence. The three gunas have been left out of the picture. And by leaving all those things out, it would seem to me that you leave out the apparatus which is required to account for the different mystical cities and so forth, which in fact are not at all understood by physical scientists. But the purpose of it is to show that even if you grant their basic assumptions, it is possible to have higher conscious control of everything. So the idea is merely to establish the possibility of that. Now going beyond that, we would suggest that in fact all these other levels of material nature must be there, mind, intelligence, and so forth. And one should expect to find phenomena associated with them. So that would be a prediction we would make on the basis of the Vedic literature. There should be many phenomena, especially associated with the mind, which are not explicable in terms of known physical principles, because these would be phenomena connected with this mind element and the intelligence. So, in fact, there are many such phenomena. And the problem one encounters in dealing with those phenomena is the scientists tend to reject them. So, I was going to talk a little bit more about that today, actually. But for the moment, are there any other questions about this topic?
If we assume that the matter is a very complex wave form, mm-hmm. combination of waves, and it's generating over different periods of time, different physical forms, how do they account for the order which we see? In other words, how do they explain the fact that it's all coming out so nicely and there's not all kinds of bizarre things also happening?
Yeah, well, you see, there are two aspects. That's a good question. Of course, what I'm presenting here is highly simplified, and I'm talking about what's called a linear wave equation. The equations in quantum mechanics have nonlinear terms, and this allows you to have standing wave patterns. Does anyone know what a standing wave is? If you pluck a guitar string, you get a certain pattern of the string that is vibrating. That's called a standing wave. So they will say an atom is a standing wave, a hydrogen atom, for example. So this is the idea first created by Niels Bohr. So that's the current idea. So a group of molecules that are linked together is simply a complicated standing wave pattern, comparable to the wave pattern on a guitar string or something like that. And a body, such as the human body, is just so and so many molecules linked together. So that is just a complicated standing wave pattern, as far as they're concerned. So, of course, this is, you can go further in discussing the philosophical implications of that. Because if the body, including the brain and so forth, is just a complicated standing wave pattern, then where is the actual person? That is, if you look closely at a wave pattern, this is what you see. Let's say you look under very high magnification at any point in the body, and all you're going to see is some wave like this. So the whole body consists of nothing but that. So in what sense, then, can that be a conscious person? This argument can be made. This, of course, brings us into a slightly different topic. But, of course, Krishna points this out, especially in the 11th canto, that there's no consciousness associated with the body. In fact, he says that anything that is made of something else is only that other thing. Krishna says this in the 11th canto. So if the body is really made just of this, some kind of vibration in some substrate, which is completely non-personal, is just a substance of some kind, then that means there's no personality there. The body is an illusion. Just as though, suppose on the surface of a lake, a pattern of waves were to produce a face. So you looked and you saw a face there. Well, you wouldn't think there was a real person there. You would say, that's just a pattern of waves that looks like a face. Well, similarly, this body then is a pattern of waves that looks like a person, but it's not. It's just a pattern of waves. So then, where is the actual person? The person must be something else. So, and if you say it's all just an illusion, then you have to ask, well, to have an illusion, you need two things. One is the source of that illusion, the thing that creates the illusion, and the second is the perceiver of the illusion. For example, you couldn't have a mirage in a desert unless there was someone out in the desert to see that mirage. Let's say there's a desert and nobody's there. So you have a layer of hot air refracting light in some way. But if there's nobody there, there's going to be no perception of a lake in that desert. So there's no mirage. So for an illusion, you need both the arrangement that creates the illusion, in this case the desert and the hot air and so forth, and you also need a perceiver. But if the body is just a wave pattern, and it's merely an illusion that that is a person, then what is the perceiver of that illusion? So you need to bring in some additional element that's just not mentioned in your theory of wave patterns and so forth. So this is an argument that you need some kind of conscious entity which is different from the physical continuum. That plus the fact that in the body is merely an illusion generated by a non-personal manifestation of energy. So we're not the body. So these considerations can be made in this context also.
Ja, som sagt, før vi går videre med del 2 af denne her forelæsning, som handler om evolution, så skal vi høre lidt musik med Maturesh.
Selfish pleasure, we lost our vision. from above. We die in prison due to lack of love. We have no choice but to leave this place. Hear the voice we try to efface. Listening within the whispering soul, the voice of a friend, the indwelling goal. In a selfish world, there is no love. In a selfish world, there is no love. In a selfish world, there is no love. In a selfish world, there is no love.
You are in jail. Do not forget, you are in jail. Do not forget, you are in chat by the network or producing it.
What I was going to talk about today is the theory of evolution. Specifically, in San Diego, we've been doing some work in investigating the empirical evidence regarding human evolution. As you know, the theory is that human beings evolved from apes by a physical process involving many transitional stages. And people have uncovered fossil evidence that has bearing on this. They will say they've basically shown how humans evolved through a series of stages with names such as Australopithecus and Homo erectus and so forth. These were different beings intermediate between man and apes, most of which lived in Africa. Some of them lived in Java and China and other such places. So this is the theory of human evolution. So we investigated that to see what kind of evidence is really there in support of this theory. And we discovered a rather interesting thing, namely that there are large amounts of evidence which support a completely different theory of human origins. And in fact, historically, early in this century and in the latter part of the 19th century, scientists who, in fact, were mostly evolutionists were gathering together a great deal of evidence in support of a different theory of evolution. At that time, they were proposing that human beings evolved from apes at a much earlier period. According to the present theory, this evolutionary process mainly took place during what they call the Pleistocene period, going back about 2 million years at most. So in the latter part of the 19th century, they had a theory saying that human beings had already pretty much evolved from apes back even as far as the Miocene period, which would mean maybe 20 million years ago, something like that, which is a very big discrepancy compared with the present theory. So what happened was that at a certain point the theoretical views changed and the acceptability of certain evidence changed. So the earlier evidence was kicked out, and then people began to accept new evidence in favor of the new viewpoint. So the this is significant in general because it indicates that in empirical studies, the theory that is considered acceptable has a very large role to play in determining what is accepted as evidence. Basically, especially in this archaeological field, but also in other areas, evidence is always imperfect because the people who find the evidence are imperfect. So you can always criticize or reject any given piece of evidence. So what happens then is that you find a double standard being used, in which evidence that goes against an accepted theory is rejected on the basis of its imperfections, but evidence that goes in favor of that theory is accepted in spite of its imperfections. So a double standard is applied. The basic conclusion we would suggest that you could derive from this is that you can't really trust these empirical studies as a means of finding out about human origins. This is true certainly of archaeological studies, which depend on large numbers of individual discoveries made by many different people in many different times and places, and also reported by many different persons in different literatures. When you have a system of discovery and transmission of knowledge involving large numbers of people in this way, there's much room for editing and misrepresentation of the evidence. And in fact, that does happen. So what we have been doing is making use of computer graphics to make videos presenting some of these ideas. So this is an example of one thing we've done. And I'll try to show this now, if everything works.
After his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image. So God created man in his own image. Male and female, he created them. Once man looked to God and higher beings to understand his nature and origin. According to Genesis, God created man and woman from the dust of the earth about 6,000 years ago. For when man started to dig in the dust of the earth, he found bones and implements that appeared to tell another story, evolution. These ideas were formulated by Charles Darwin in his book, Origin of Species. In this book, Darwin did not say much about human evolution, only that much light would be thrown on the origin of man and his history. This brief remark set off a revolution in thought, and by the 1870s, the belief in the origin of man by evolution from ape-like ancestors had become dominant among scientists and academics throughout the Western world. Began drawing family trees, showing how the human species evolved from lower animals. This particular tree was drawn by the German naturalist Ernst Haeckel. The only problem with this picture was that there was precious little evidence to support it. At first, they had only Neanderthal man to fill in the gaps, too human-like and too recent to be a missing link. But scientists committed to Darwinian evolution expected that fossils of a genuine ape man, sufficiently ancient, would soon be found. In fact, Haeckel commissioned this painting, showing exactly how he should appear. He called him Pithecanthropus alalus, the speechless ape man. And scientists were not disappointed. Fossils said to represent a whole series of intermediates were discovered over the next several decades. Here is a picture that emerged. In 1894, the Dutch physician Eugene Dubois discovered a primitive skull and thigh bone in Java, thus realizing the dream of Haeckel's Pithecanthropus alalis. Today, Java man, along with Peking man and other specimens, is known as Homo erectus. Homo erectus is thought to have lived from 1.6 million to 300,000 years ago. Modern man, represented by Cro-Magnon man, is thought to have first appeared about 40,000 years ago. Neanderthal man, now generally thought to be an offshoot from the main line of evolution, existed from 150,000 to 35,000 years ago. In the 1920s, a South African scientist found this first specimen of the creature now called Australopithecus, a small, erect, ape-like being thought to represent the human lineage at 2 to 3 million years ago. In the 1950s, Lewis and Mary Leakey discovered Homo habilis, an intermediate between Australopithecus and Homo erectus. According to the current scenario, the initial stages of evolution from Australopithecus to Homo erectus took place in Africa. Homo erectus then left Africa and spread widely throughout the tropical and temperate latitudes of the Old World. Somewhere in this broad region, it is believed Homo erectus evolved into Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens completely replaced Homo erectus and moved on into the northern regions of the Old World. No more than 20,000 years ago, Homo sapiens is thought to have crossed into North America and populated the New World. This is the standard scenario of human evolution. But over the past 150 years, much evidence has been discovered that radically contradicts this picture. At all ages, in this picture of fossil history, and even earlier, scientists have found evidence for the presence of Homo sapiens. What is this evidence, and why have so few people heard of it? First of all, we should understand that our whole picture of man's prehistoric past is based on four kinds of physical evidence: stone tools, incised bones, human skeletal remains, and other artifacts. A stone tool like this one, from a site in Torralba, Spain, may look like an ordinary rock. But experts in lithic technology can identify the chipping and fracturing as the product of human work. In a similar fashion, experts can tell the difference between marks made by animal teeth and those made by flint tools on fossil bones. This cut bone was found at a Cro-Magnon site. This Cro-Magnon skeleton was unearthed in France during the 19th century. Most paleoanthropologists would not expect such skeletons of modern human type to be older than 40,000 years. Scientists interested in human prehistory also study artifacts such as paintings, statues, carvings, and pottery, which they tend to regard as very recent. But now let's investigate the large body of evidence in these categories that contradicts the modern picture of man's origins, starting with that found in Europe. In the 1850s, Carlos Ribeiro, the head of the Geological Survey of Portugal, found these tools in the Miocene strata of the Tagus River Valley near Lisbon. To get some idea of the astounding age of Ribeiro's discoveries, let's look at a chart of the geological ages. The Miocene extends from 5 to 25 million years ago. At present, the most primitive accepted stone tools all lie within the Pleistocene, being at most 2 million years old. Tools of the type discovered by Ribeiro in Miocene formations are generally found in the Upper Pleistocene and are characteristic of fully modern man. At present, extinct apes are the highest primates assigned to the Miocene. Then what made Ribeiro's tools? Are they really artifacts, or are they products of nature? Let's compare Ribeiro's tool with an accepted stone tool made by Neanderthal man in the late Pleistocene, less than 100,000 years ago. On both, large flakes were removed in parallel, something not likely to occur in the course of random battering by natural forces. The opposite sides of both pieces display additional features typical of human work, such as the vocal percussion caused by a single directed blow that removed the flake from a flint cord, the striking platform, the surface upon which the blow was struck, the aurelia, a small chip removed from the vocal percussion. In every respect, Ribeiro's Miocene tools resemble those accepted by scientists as the product of human work. Despite such evidence, many scientists resisted the conclusion that human beings manufactured tools in the Miocene. At an International Congress of Archaeology and Anthropology held in Lisbon in 1871, a commission of scientists was appointed to examine the sites of Ribeiro's discoveries. One member of this commission, the Italian geologist Jay Bellucci, found this tool in Miocene strata. All the scientists present agreed it was identical to late Pleistocene scraping tools. This led some to claim that it was indeed a late Pleistocene tool that had been washed into a Miocene formation from above. But the tool was found firmly embedded in the upper surface of an overhanging section of the Miocene layers. Stone tools even older than those of Portugal were found by the Abbé Bourgeois at Tenay in France. Many of the tools were found embedded in undisturbed Oligocene formations, and this indicates an age of from 25 to 38 million years. Especially noteworthy is the retouching on the edges of the implements. This retouching is confined to one side of the working edge of the implement. It is obvious that several small flakes have been removed in succession, and most are oriented in the same general direction. Such retouching is generally regarded as a sure sign of intentional work. The implements from the Oligocene of Tenay display the same features as this accepted scraper from an upper Pleistocene site in France. Here are more examples of unifacially retouched implements from the Oligocene at Tenay, reproduced from 19th century scientific journals. At another site near Aurillac in southern France, several scientists recovered stone implements from Miocene formations during the 19th century. In 1905, the German scientist Max Verworn sought to confirm these discoveries by conducting his own excavations at Aurillac. He personally recovered these implements from the Miocene formations there. Here, the cortex, or inner surface of the flint, has been removed from the working edges, which have been carefully chipped to form a point. Scientists such as Henry Bruhl sought to prove the natural origin of such implements. At an excavation near Clermont in France, Bruhl found specimens like these, with small chips of flint lying close to the parent blocks, apparently removed by geological pressure. Because this occurred in an Eocene formation, Bruhl believed human work of any kind could be ruled out. He was convinced human beings could not have existed from 38 to 55 million years ago. On the basis of this preconception, he concluded that all the flints resembling tools found in the same Eocene stratum had also been formed by geological pressure, including this one and this one. In fact, Bruhl said that it was stupefying to find, in an Eocene formation, an implement such as this, which he said looked exactly like a late Pleistocene tool made by Homo sapiens. But here is an important fact. Specimens of this level of sophistication were not found with the chips in place. Geological pressure might have produced effects like this, does not mean it can produce implements like this, complete with wear marks in the appropriate places. It would thus appear that Bruhl found a genuine human artifact in an Eocene formation. On the coast of East Anglia in England, J. Reed Moore and other researchers reported several intriguing discoveries. This pointed piece of wood was recovered from the Cromer forest bed in East Anglia. The right end has been cut off flat, as if by sawing. The Cromer forest bed formation dates to the latter part of the early Pleistocene and is about 1 to 1.5 million years old. J. Reed Moore noted that at one spot it seems that... to see how such sawing could have been accomplished without tools considered quite modern. Another discovery was this carved shell, presented in 1881 by geologist Henry Stokes to the British Association for the Advancement of Science. It was recovered from the Red Crag Formation, which is 1.5 to 2 million years old. It may be recalled that according to standard opinion, human beings capable of such work did not appear in Europe before 40,000 years ago. Below the Red Crag Formation is a layer called the detritus bed, lying upon the Eocene London clay. It is composed of fossils and sediments from the Pliocene, Miocene, and Oligocene periods. Anything found here could be anywhere from 2 to 38 million years old. J. Readmore recovered these bone implements from the detritus bed below the Red Crag. The fractures that form the points go across the natural grain of the bone, indicating intentional work rather than natural breakage. Also discovered in the detritus bed was this round object, characterized by Henry Brühl, one of Europe's leading experts on prehistoric man, as a sling stone similar to those used recently in New Caledonia. But this is not likely to have occurred simply by the random movement of the bones in the currents of streams. If the bones really belong together, that means that a Pliocene animal died at that place, and that the formation really is 2 to 5 million years old, as are the stone tools found there. And here is a further interesting fact. Carlos Ameghino found embedded in the Toxodon femur a stone arrowhead, more evidence for the presence of technologically sophisticated human beings over 2 million years ago in Argentina. Human skull was discovered in 1896 by workmen excavating a dry dock in the harbor of Buenos Aires. It was found in the rudder pit of the dry dock at a depth of about 35 feet below the bottom of the river, just after the workmen broke through a hard limestone-like layer of tosca. The sediments in which the skull was found are 1.5 to 2.5 million years old. Some might object that no scientist was present at the moment of discovery by the workmen. The workmen also discovered the Heidelberg jaw, which is fully accepted as an example of Homo erectus in the Middle Pleistocene of Europe. In the 1850s, miners first panned for gold in the gravels of California rivers. Later, they dug mine shafts at places like Table Mountain in Tuolumne County in order to get at the gold-bearing gravels. The gravels were originally deposited in rivers that flowed here millions of years ago during the Miocene period and earlier. At the end of the Miocene, volcanic eruptions covered the entire area with basalt. Then, in more recent times, rivers cut new valleys, leaving formations like Table Mountain with deposits of gold-bearing gravel now buried beneath layers of basalt. In 1877, John H. Neal entered the Montezuma mine shaft at Table Mountain. He proceeded 1,400 to 1,500 feet inside. Then, at the working end of the shaft, he discovered in the undisturbed gold-bearing gravel this mortar and pestle, along with several stone spearheads. Neal testified he saw no fissures by which the objects could have entered from above. Gravels at Table Mountain date at least to the late Miocene, and therefore the objects found in them would be 7 to 9 million years old. Some modern geologists say the ancient river channels are from the Eocene period and could thus be as much as 55 million years old. Miners made similar discoveries at dozens of nearby locations. This mortar and pestle were found in 1861 in gold-bearing gravel 16 feet below the surface at Kincaid Flat. These turned up at Gold Spring Gulch. And this, 200 feet inside the Boston Tunnel Company mine at Table Mountain. This interesting object was found in 1864, 16 feet below the surface in gold-bearing gravel at Oregon Bar in Placer County. These examples and many others were reported by J.D. Witten, the state geologist of California. Nevertheless, some objected that they were all hoaxes by miners. But in 1869, Clarence D. King of the U.S. Geological Survey discovered this pestle, firmly in place at Table Mountain. It is shown alongside a modern Indian pestle. The American anthropologist W.H. Holmes rejected the California finds mainly because they did not fit in with his ideas about evolution. The discovery of Java Man had put an ape man in the Middle Pleistocene, so how could you have an advanced stone tool-making man in the Miocene or Eocene? According to Holmes, it was completely out of the question. Nevertheless, many scientists, most of them evolutionists, had discovered abundant evidence for a human presence in the Pliocene, Miocene, and earlier periods. But with the discovery of Java Man, and later of Australopithecus, this evidence disappeared from view, mostly because it did not fit into the newly emerging scenario of human evolution. Today, practically no one has even heard of this evidence. If you want to find out about it, you have to dig into obscure 19th century journals, mainly in foreign languages. Of course, it is possible to point out discrepancies in the evidence that goes against the current theory of human evolution, but the reporting of evidence that is said to support it is also full of discrepancies. First, let's consider Java Man. Since Dubois made his initial discovery here at Trinil, scientists have made many more finds at other sites in Java. These fossils are now categorized along with the original Java Man as Homo erectus. In 1978, a standard textbook gave the Java Homo erectus fossils potassium argon dates of from 700,000 years to 2 million years ago. The chart in the book lists 24 discoveries. Of these, at least 18, or 75%, were found on the surface or came from unknown locations and are thus unsuitable for potassium-argon dating. 14 were initially found by native collectors. And 4 were found in a museum in Holland 30 years after their discovery with no clue to their original stratigraphic location. The potassium-argon method does not date the bone itself, but rather is used to test the age of volcanic deposits. Only if a fossil is found beneath an undisturbed layer of volcanic material is it possible to assign it a date using this method. Devastating criticism could have been brought to bear on the Java Man fossils because most were found on the surface at poorly specified locations by paid native collectors, but no such criticism was leveled. Instead, scientists simply dressed up this imperfect evidence with undeserved potassium-argon dates that allowed the fossils to be easily fitted into the accepted outline of human evolution. This double standard in the treatment of evidence is a general phenomenon. Let's consider how this process of selective acceptance and rejection of evidence operates in a related field we have already briefly touched upon, the peopling of the new world. The view now being vigorously defended is that Homo sapiens crossed over from Siberia not more than 20,000 years ago. Yet scientists have discovered a great deal of evidence suggesting a far more ancient human presence in the New World. Even though this evidence is comparable in quality and quantity to the evidence used to support the dominant view, it is rejected by establishment scientists. For example, in 1899, Ernest Volpe, a collector for the Peabody Museum of Natural History at Harvard, found a Homo sapiens femur embedded in glacial strata at Trenton, New Jersey. The layer in which the bone was found is said by the New Jersey Geological Survey to be about 107,000 years old. This small statue, found in Nampa, Idaho in 1889, came from an encased well shaft at a depth of 300 feet. The level at which it was found is now dated by the U.S. Geological Survey as being between 300,000 and 2 million years old. The Nampa image is comparable to the famous Willendorf Venus, attributed to Cro-Magnon man in Europe. Man is not thought to have made such works of art until 30,000 years ago. By the way, the Venus of Willendorf was found by a road workman. This coin-like object, was recovered at a depth of over 100 feet from a well boring in Illinois. The Geological Survey of Illinois states that the formation in which it was found is from 200,000 to 400,000 years old. The discovery was initially reported by William E. Dubois of the Smithsonian Institution. In the early 1960s, Louis Leakey located an early man site at Calico in Southern California, with stone tools found in strata dated at 200,000 years old. In succeeding years, thousands of implements have been recovered from the Calico site, including this beaked graver. If scientists are reluctant to modify their view concerning man's entry into the Americas, they are even more hesitant to change their view that modern man first appeared within the past 40,000 years and evolved from ape-like ancestors originating in Africa. Evolutionists pride themselves on having done away with the idea that man was created 10,000 years ago, but not much has changed. The present dominant view is that human beings of modern type still can be dated back only a few thousand years. Before that, there was only a primitive man fading off into ape-like life. But this film confronts us with abundant evidence that human beings of modern type have existed for tens of millions of years into the past, in geological ages distant from our own.
What we're dealing with here is evidence for people at a primitive level of culture. At least most of it is. Those mortars and so forth found in the California mines are at what would be called probably a Neolithic level, practically. However, one should keep in mind these are discoveries made by scientists who were firmly believing in evolution. And they were seeking evidence of the evolution of man from more primitive ancestors. So they were reporting this kind of evidence. You see, all the evidence that we mention here has been reported in scientific journals. We showed some of the titles of those journals, for example. So at one time, all of this was accepted by scientists. At least, that's not to say it was universally accepted, but it was accepted to the extent that it was published in journals, discussed in conferences, and so forth. And there was a substantial school of thought which did regard this as being valid evidence. So you don't find here any evidence for, say, advanced civilization. But then scientists have never been willing to accept the idea of advanced civilization in very ancient strata. The main significance of this, from our point of view, is that it shows how evidence is used within the scientific community. As I was saying, basically, if you have a prevailing theoretical view which is compatible with certain evidence, then that evidence can be accepted. And if the basic view changes so that now that evidence is incompatible with the accepted theory, then the evidence will be rejected. So very few people even know about most of the finds that we were discussing here. And we have a large number of others. We could only fit so much material into a half-hour presentation. But there's a very large amount of material along these lines. And most people, say, in universities who study anthropology and so forth, don't even know about this. So to find out about it, you have to dig in the libraries. And that's actually what we did in order to find this material. So this shows then that the empirical process can be misleading. One will be told that we have a certain theory and there's certain evidence to back it up, but there may be a whole body of evidence that completely disagrees with it, which has been eliminated on that basis. So as far as ancient civilization is concerned, now in the second half of this video, we're going to introduce some more controversial topics than the material we've introduced here. There is evidence suggesting civilization in ridiculously remote periods. And in fact, from a scientific point of view, it's so bizarre that it's hard to make sense out of it at all. because you will find a scattering of artifacts indicating advanced culture in strata going back as far as the Carboniferous period or the even the Precambrian period. I'll explain those terms. The Carboniferous is the main age of coal formation. So, for example, the coal deposits in England are practically all Carboniferous. The same is true of most of the coal deposits in the United States, especially in Pennsylvania. It's all Carboniferous. So that goes back about 250 million years, according to present dating. And according to accepted theory of evolution, you had amphibians living in that period, which were basically similar to alligators or crocodiles in shape. There were creatures such as the uriops and so forth. But there were no reptiles, what to speak of mammals or human beings or anything similar to that. But there are various reports of people finding such things as a gold chain in a block of coal or an iron pot. There are reports of human skeletal remains found in coal deposits and so forth. But these have never been accepted by the scientific community. So the only place in which you can find such reports would be, for example, newspapers. We actually investigated this, and we would write to certain newspapers in different places and have them send us Xeroxes of the old issues. So there are definitely newspaper reports of discoveries of this type. Another example would be in the in an early version of Scientific American in 1852, there was a report that a metal vase with inlaid flower designs was came out of rock during blasting in Dorset, Massachusetts. And there's a description of the stratum there, so we checked with the Geological Survey to find out how old that would be. And they say it's Precambrian rock, which means over 600 million years. So these discoveries are simply utterly bizarre from the point of view of accepted scientific theory. Nonetheless, they do exist. Our point, however, is not to try to give much importance to these discoveries as such, that is, as actual evidences for a human presence, say, in the Precambrian period or something like that. What we're mainly concerned to do is show how evidence is processed. The main argument is that the empirical process is really quite faulty. Of course, Srila Prabhupada always stressed that there are the four defects of the conditioned soul: imperfect senses and tendency to make mistakes, be an illusion, and also the cheating tendency. So on first hearing that, one may tend to think that, of course, these things are there, but they don't have a really significant impact. Our senses may be imperfect, but with instruments we can improve the senses. And, of course, people do make mistakes, but if you have many people working, other people will correct the mistakes made by certain people and so on and so forth. But what we see is that there's that these defects of the conditioned soul do have a significant impact on the development of scientific understanding of the world. And that is the main point we're making in discussing this evidence. So, yeah?
There was a recent issue of the National Geographic. They did a whole practical issue of the origins of man, different parts of the world, concentrating on the migration theories, such as you show. There was a statement there, the effect that very little work had actually been done in India and Southeast Asia. Little exploratory work. Can you comment? Those are the places, of course, where we would expect to find.
Yeah. Well, there's always the question of what you might find in India. Yes, relatively little work has been done there. There's a very active school of archaeology in India at the present time. Basically, those archaeologists are following the example set by the British and finding things that are more or less in conformity with accepted views. For example, they will say that they have excavated the site of Hastinapur. And they will say that Hastinapur goes back at most to about 800 BC. And at the level of 800 BC, it was a very crude village with mud brick walls, probably thatched huts and things like that. Nothing more advanced than that. And nothing of any significance was built there until about 300 BC, they will say. So you can find reports of this kind. Now, there's another school of thought in Indian archaeology, which is oriented, it seems to me, in a more nationalistic fashion. And discoveries are reported suggesting a continuous civilization in India back to about 2000 BC. For example, you've probably heard about excavations of Dwarka. I was just talking with this fellow, S.R. Rao, who is conducting those excavations. Basically, they just send divers down from boats off the coast of Dwarka, and they find stone walls and various artifacts and so forth under the ocean there. So he's advocating the view that they're actually discovering the city, Krishna's city of Dwarka. And he gives a date of 1500 BC for that, based on different dating methods. So these discoveries are interesting because this is a much earlier date than I think is generally considered acceptable by Western archaeologists, or even by many Indian archaeologists, as far as civilization in India is concerned. Basically, they try generally to give fairly recent dates for civilization in India. So it remains to be seen, though, what discoveries might be made there. So, as I say, the basic point we're making is that the discoveries that are made, reported, and accepted are very highly conditioned by the theoretical views of the people involved. So if you're not willing to accept a given kind of thing as being possible, then you're not going to discover it. Or if you do discover it, it's not going to be reported. Yeah?
There are also some stories about evidence which was completely suppressed, not, at least the material you showed here, apparently it was published at some time because it conformed to at least the present evolutionary theory, but there was also evidence which was from the moment of the discovery, it was really...
Yes. Of course, if evidence is suppressed from the moment of its discovery, it's hard to find out about it because it was suppressed. As I say, here we find things that at one time were acceptable to scientists, at least scientists of a certain school of thought. So they were published. Then later, those ideas went out of fashion. So now you can only find the publications in old journals. They're not mentioned in recent writings. Now, these accounts of gold chains in Carboniferous coal and things like that only appear in popular sources, such as newspapers. You just don't find those in scientific publications. So there may be even other things that don't get reported at all. This suppression of evidence that doesn't fit one's theory is a general phenomenon. You can see the same thing in this whole area of parapsychology, for example, or psychical phenomena. There are many, many reports of phenomena which are generally called psychic, ranging from poltergeists to extrasensory perception to human levitation, people who can resist the effect of fire, all kinds of unusual things. There are great masses of reports along these lines, but you find that scientists don't accept this material at all. So it's a general phenomenon.
There was some, was it in Badger Gullet or something, I saw something, but it was very recent. It was some, I think, contemporary scientist, a lady, who made some discovery which would have required the rewriting of the dates or something like that. She couldn't get published, and she was, and she had professional problems, or they were lost her place in the university.
I don't know what you're referring to there. There are many cases like that. For example, when we were writing the Origins magazine, one case that we dealt with was a discovery in Mexico at a place called Huayatlico, where some spearheads were found of a fairly advanced type of workmanship that in Europe would be assigned to about 30,000 to 40,000 years ago. So these were found in Mexico, and they were given dates, I think by a team from the U.S. Geological Survey, of 250,000 years ago. And these dates were assigned by several different methods, which all agreed on the date. This is the way the report went. So we wanted to use some pictures of those spear points in that magazine. So we called up the lady who made the original discovery to ask for permission to use photographs, because you have to do this in order to avoid copyright violations and so forth. So she said to us that I'll give you permission to use the photographs if you assign a date of at most 30,000 years to those spear points. But if you cite that lunatic fringe date of 250,000 years, then I deny permission to use the materials. So these things are going on. Yeah?
Is it the right time to speak a little bit about the recent evolution of civilization with Indo-Europeans invading India and the evolution of language from
Well, I could mention something about that. There's not much that I can say about it, because that's a whole subject that would have to be researched properly. However, it would appear there is no physical evidence for an Aryan invasion of India. So this idea of an Aryan invasion, it would appear, is mainly a theory developed for political purposes. It was very effective as a method of divide and conquer in India. The idea was that one can say that in India, the people who originally lived there were the Dravidians. And then later on, the Aryans, speaking languages related to Sanskrit, invaded and took over a good part of the country, except for the southern part of India, which is still Dravidian. So this can be used to create dissension within India, and in fact that's going on. There are political parties today of Dravidians who are opposed to Aryans and so forth. But there's no physical evidence indicating that such an invasion ever took place. And some scholars in India have pointed out that in all the Vedic literatures, including the Rig Veda and so forth, there are no references indicating that the people ever came from another location. Now, this is interesting because in the traditions of many people around the world, you do find stories indicating that they came from another place. For example, even the ancient Egyptians had the story that their ancestors came from a land called Punt, just to give one example. So they didn't regard themselves as indigenous to Egypt. They thought they came from somewhere else. But there's no reference of this kind in any of the Vedic literatures. And yet they're dated back to a time very close to the supposed time when the Aryan invasion took place. So in any event, mainly you have a lack of evidence. Of course, the strongest argument which is used for an Aryan invasion is that there is a clear-cut similarity between Sanskrit and various Indian languages and languages spoken in Europe and also other parts of Asia. So either then these languages must have initially been spoken in India and then there had to be a radiation going out of India, or else they were spoken somewhere outside of India and there had to be an invasion going into India. So if you adopt the first point of view, you'd have to say that the main languages spoken in Europe are derived ultimately from India, which is not considered very acceptable. So therefore, the opposite point of view is presented. The theory is entirely based on language. That's the point. There's no physical evidence in terms of artifacts. There are no inscriptions dating to ancient times indicating an Indo-European invasion, nor are there any traditions which survive to the present day indicating such a thing. So the analysis is, the theory is entirely based on similarities between languages and an attempt to reconstruct the history of language by analyzing how words are supposed to change in form over the centuries and so forth. Based on studying the grammatical structure of language and the form of the words and so forth, they will argue that a given language had to have a given ancestor and so forth. They've actually constructed a language that they call Proto-Indo-European. In fact, you even find Proto-Indo-European roots of words in some dictionaries. But it's entirely an artificial construction based on theories of how languages change with time. So that's the real basis for their arguments. They say there's no archaeological evidence.
Is the dating of the Vedas also done the same way?
The dating, yeah, you're dealing with a whole process of textual criticism, they call it. Scholars will examine different texts and try to analyze on the basis of the kind of vocabulary used, the particular grammatical forms and so forth, what the historical development of the texts actually was. So, once again, this is a whole subject one would have to go into. I'll just give you an example of what goes on here. I have one book which purports to give a translation of the hieroglyphic writing of the Harappan civilization in the Indus Valley. They also call that the Indus Valley civilization. So in this book, the Harappan hieroglyphics are translated as being in the Sanskrit language. Now, I have another article, this was from Scientific American actually, in which the same Harappan hieroglyphics are translated as being in a Dravidian language, which is a completely different language. So, obviously somebody is wrong there, because you have the same thing being translated as, or being interpreted as belonging to two completely different languages. But this is an area that one would have to delve into. As I say, the basic principle that we're getting at with this presentation and others that we're also working on is that there is a great deal of room for error in these empirical studies, and you can have wholesale misrepresentation of evidence. But to show that that's happening in any given case, you have to do a tremendous amount of work in order to uncover all the different things that are going on. I might mention one interesting thing about India is that there are local traditions which support the idea of the existence of a Vedic civilization. Because many of the different events described in literature such as the Bhagavatam are also described in specific local traditions in different parts of India. Now, someone may argue that the events in the Bhagavatam were just created by imaginative poets at some point, and then people in general adopted these ideas as the scriptures were spread around. One can proposed that. But then you have to explain how it is that these specific local traditions arose. For example, in the Himalayas, there's a town, this is just one example, called Nirmand, where the tradition is that this town was founded by Parashurama in the Treta Yuga. Now, in this town, every 12 years, they have a festival in which they worship Renuka, the mother of Parashurama. And the tradition is that this was instituted by Parashurama himself in order to do penance for murdering his mother. Because, you know, in the Bhagavatam, it's described that Parashurama killed his mother on the order of Janmadagni, his father. Then Janmadagni brought her back to life again and so forth. So this festival that they hold, or at least did hold up until very recent times, is quite expensive because, first of all, it's a very poor village. So typically they almost go bankrupt every time they hold this festival. So you might ask, how did a tradition like that get started? You know, why Parashurama's mother, of all things? One would have to argue that if one wants to say that Parashurama is mythological, one would have to argue that at a certain point, people in that village decided that, well, let's say the village was founded by Parashurama and let's institute a festival like this and so forth, with all these elaborate customs and traditions and so forth. So, at least it seems plausible that one could argue that the tradition is genuine, which would say that Parashurama must be a historical personality. Then this is supported by the fact that there are many different towns in different parts of India in which the local tradition is that Parashurama founded that particular place. In fact, what Parashurama was apparently doing was establishing towns in which would be dedicated to certain Brahminical functions. A typical town would involve a core of 500 Brahmins and their families, plus other people to provide agricultural support and so forth. And there would also be land grants associated with that town. So the whole object of the town would be performance of a particular religious function. For example, one town, they may say, well, this town was founded for the study of the Yajur Veda by a group of Brahmins and so forth. So these traditions exist in local form in different parts of India. So one interpretation of that would be that Parashurama must have actually existed. Otherwise, all these things would have to have been created at some point in many different places.
When you see now, there's so many kinds of instruments we have now, very difficult, complicated instruments. Why they find only this piece of stone? We say that the civilization is actually higher.
Now, I was explaining that. The point is, these are reports by scientists who are looking for evidence of primitive man. Naturally, they were only reporting primitive things. That was the kind of thing they were looking for and presenting. So, you see, what you're faced with is this. At present, according to accepted scientific views, you won't find any kind of human artifact in strata of, say, the Miocene period. There's just nothing there at all. But in the 19th century, people were regularly finding primitive stone implements and things like that in strata of the Miocene. And they were expecting to find such things. Now, you might say they weren't finding advanced things. But then you can turn to non-scientific sources and find reports of that sort of thing. But, of course, those reports are highly disreputable because they're from such things as newspapers. So how can you put much faith in something that's simply reported in a newspaper? So what we're really doing here is examining how people treat evidence. And the real lesson to get from it is an understanding of to what extent we can rely on the empirical process. because one is really depending on other people making discoveries and then reporting them, writing them down, transmitting them to us in some sort of written form. So in the course of that process, what happens to the information and what gets through to us and in what form does it come through? So the point is, evidence gets transformed, edited, suppressed, and so forth as it is processed by different scholars, scientists, and so on and so forth. And this isn't limited just to scientists, of course. It's just a general human phenomenon. So the real point is that this method of finding out about reality is not very reliable. So our final suggestion then would be that you can't really use this method in order to understand, let's say, the origin of human beings or their ancient history. You'll be misled by making use of it.
Could it be understood that one reason we don't find so much human skeletons of the time, for example, of Krishna or the Vedic civilization, would also be because at that time the dead were not buried, but they were cremated, so you cannot find remains of skeleton that have been transformed into powder?
Yeah. Well, skeletal remains in general are very rare. Even if people weren't cremating the dead, it's well known that human skeletons don't tend to survive very long because there are processes in the soil which tend to break them down. In France, for example, there are cave deposits in which, you know, you have 50 feet of deposits indicating human beings living in some cave with all kinds of artifacts and so forth, and not a trace of a human bone in the whole thing. There are many examples like this. So the indication is that even if people aren't cremating the dead, skeletal remains don't last very long.
Jeg vil sige tak til Sataputra Das og hans publikum. Du har lyttet til en udsendelse fra Radio Krishna. Din studievært og tekniker i denne afdeling hed Yadunandan Das. Jeg siger tak for nu. Hare Krishna, og på genhør.